It's October 7, 1897, in New York, and the headless torso trial has begun. A professional artist for William Randolph Hearst's New York Journal sketches the scene in the courtroom, his pen moving furiously across the page. It's his first time working with birds. Not his subjects, no birds are on trial here. We're talking about carrier pigeons, a world-class breed. Hearst has spent thousands to rig up a system of birds to feed his paper the latest trial news. The artist draws witnesses testifying, lawyers laying out arguments, spectators fainting, anything newsworthy. Then he rolls the paper up, slips it into a leather-bound tube, and sets it in the claws of the pigeon, and off it flies. On the stand this crisp fall day is Augusta Knack, or Gussie as she's often called. The district attorney has been asking her, why the day before the murders, she cleaned the bathtub in Woodside with ammonia.
Is it also true that you hired an undertaker's carriage to transport several heavy parcels you had wrapped up with cheesecloth?
I just want to make my peace with the people and with God.
Answer the question.
Carrier or passenger pigeons would be hunted to extinction by 1914. But at the end of the 19th century, they're a common sight around New York. The sound of their wings flapping during takeoffs and landings has become familiar in the courtroom. Now the pigeon flies with its cargo across the East River from the courthouse in Queens to the Journal newsroom in Lower Manhattan. The trip takes the bird just 2 minutes at its top speed of 90 miles an hour. Hearst, after all, has insisted on champion racing pigeons. Anything to give the Journal a better chance at a scoop. As each pigeon arrives at the newsroom, copy boys unroll their cargo and editors huddle eagerly around the pages. These images of the day's courtroom action will be reproduced in multiple editions of the paper. These are the money shots that keep customers plunking down their 2 cents per copy.
Got it! Oh, just look at the expression on her face.
Hearst loves it.
Run it above the fold, life size. I want it like she's standing right next to our readers, almost haunting them.
As she's holding up the sketch to simulate how it will look on the front page, a secretary passes by and glances in. Seeing the image even across the room, she lets out a gasp. Hearst and his editor exchange a grin. Just a few more hours before the next edition captivates the city once again.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's vice chair and president, Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though many of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill talk about how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can check out this episode and a whole lot more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts.
From Wondery, this is Business Wars. I'm David Brown. And you are listening to the second episode in our 6-part series on Hearst and Pulitzer. And once again, Lindsey Graham is joining me from Wondery's podcast, American History Tellers. Together, we're covering the greatest newspaper rivalry in all of American history, two giants of the industry whose names live on over a century later. We saw how the battle between their two flagship New York papers, The World and The Journal, came to a head, no pun intended, over a lurid murder dubbed the Headless Torso Case.
It is the dawning of an age of mass media. The Headless Torso Case belongs to the whole city. Everyone, from a barkeep in Brooklyn to a banker on the Upper East Side, is invested in who killed William Guldenzuppa and what happened to his head. Hearst and Pulitzer are pushing for every possible advantage, knowing that the more sensational they can make the coverage, the more papers they will sell. They don't want to just cover what the authorities say about the case. They want to beat the cops to the punch by solving it themselves.
As the Headless Torso murder turns to a courtroom drama, William Randolph Hearst's journal doesn't want to miss a second in the trial. No anguished witness testimony, no bare-knuckled attorney cross-examination, or any gruesome new piece of evidence. Since William Randolph Hearst comes from money, the journal's resources seem infinite. Hearst's mother had inherited $7.5 million from her husband. That's more than $200 million in today's dollars. She gave her son nearly half of that for a proper start in New York. One of his investments? The intricate system of carrier pigeons. As each sketch is dashed off in the courtroom, these trained birds fly them back to the newsroom in 2 minutes flat. In print, these illustrations give the Headless Torso saga an emotional dimension readers aren't used to. This isn't just about a dismembered body. It's the whole messy human drama that led up to the murder in a shotgun shack in Queens. The sketches are a key part of bringing that story to life. The World is on a tighter budget, but it manages to come up with a response to the journal's pigeons, an expensive live telegraph system made for the Headless Torso trial. Instead of having to wait for reporters to file their copy, the entire editorial team can tune in and keep track of the action by listening to the crackly audio transmission. Pulitzer and his team crowd around it in the World newsroom.
Turn it up. I can't hear what the judge is saying.
He just said that he could cite everyone in the audience for contempt of court. They keep booing the witness.
Well, then why are you just standing there? That's a story.
I'm on it, boss. Eat our dust, Hearst.
File fast and make it sing. And remember, you have details from that telegraph that nobody else has. I want you to hook me from the first line or don't bother coming back.
But both papers believe they won't beat the other if all they do is report on the case. They need to crack it. Solving the Headless Torso murder will not only be a point of pride, but a commercial bonanza. And these days, police detectives have fewer tools and stand less of a chance than the papers. The Journal's pack of reporters is nicknamed the Wrecking Crew, and it's running circles around the detectives. In their mustaches and derby hats, they run down leads, interview witnesses, get evidence tested in labs, and even make arrests. The alpha member of the Wrecking Crew is editor Sam Selwyn Chamberlain. The son of a newspaperman, he's a veteran of many New York newsrooms. At 46, he has a decade of grizzled experience on Hearst, but you wouldn't know it by his boundless energy. He bellows at reporters to chase down leads faster.
Get excited! God damn it, get excited!
Chamberlain cuts a debonair figure. Before he met Hearst, he lived in Paris and helped launch a daily paper called Le Matin. Chamberlain is known as the best-dressed man in the trade. He layers frock coats over English tweed and never goes without his monocle and a fresh gardenia in his lapel. His combination of personal style and uncanny news sense makes Chamberlain a prototype that would be widely emulated. As stylish as the Wrecking Crew could look, their journalism doesn't always meet the same standard. Occasionally, they go over the top, offering bribes in exchange for hot tips. Early on in the Headless Torso case, two reporters thought police were letting the prime suspect get away. As his carriage was making its way down 9th Avenue, they took matters into their own hands. They leapt into the moving carriage and made a citizen's arrest. Unfortunately, for all that effort, the suspect was eventually released due to a lack of evidence. Even when they make mistakes, every ounce of hustle keeps the journal ahead of police and the lawyers. It gives them credibility with the increasingly news-addicted public, and it brings them closer to vanquishing their rival. The World has had its time in the sun. It's now time for a new leader in the news business.
It's October, 1897. The Headless Torso trial hasn't yet produced a coherent theory as to how the murder was pulled off by Augusta Knack and Martin Thorne. Prosecutors have established motive, that is, the why, but not the procedure, the how. The Journal is working every angle. Hearst tries to fire up his reporters.
Remember, everyone, we're spending whatever it takes to show the Journal it is superior to all rivals. So I want you to give me your very best material. We're learning a lot more about this William Guldenzupa, I can tell you that. His body, well, pieces of it anyway, is on ice. I got a good look at it in the morgue. Big, strong fella, but smooth, silky hands. Got a tip he worked as a masseur at the Murray Hill Baths, which would make sense. And get this. A guy in the morgue showed me this tattoo, some sort of German insignia. Well, he was called Guldenzupa. Some name. Wonder if he checked into hotels under that name.
I want every scrap of detail you have on this fellow.
And why do we know so little about how it happened? I want our readers to be able to picture the scene.
They're supposed to take the jury down to the shack in Queens. Give them a look around the place before they start talking about blood splatters over here, brain matter over there, you know, all that stuff. Hey, this can't leave this room, but we've got a good source on the jury. I took the guy for a beer the other night, and he slipped the guard 2 bits to let him out of sequestration for an hour. You know, remember that scoop about how the jury wants the death penalty? That guy was my source.
The reporters look at each other, then at Hearst.
Now, I will deny telling you this, but I want you to do whatever it takes. Quietly, but get us deep into those deliberations, as deep as we can get.
Down Park Row, the world has been under intense assault. Pulitzer's eager to deliver some counterpunches. He looks the other way when reporters bribe medical examiners in the morgue. But he draws the line at the jury. That's interfering with the American legal system, the fairest in the free world. Pulitzer also has some ace reporters on his team, but he can't escape the shadow of his deep-pocketed counterpart. In the world offices, he makes things clear to his staff, repeatedly using an odd catchphrase.
I want you to smash the interloper.
It probably sounded better in the original Hungarian.
Boss, he's no interloper. Hearst is the first serious threat you've faced since you got to New York. He's spending money like he's burning a hole in his pocket.
Threat? He's a kid. What can he do? The man he bought the paper from was a serious businessman. He knew the value of money. Hearst doesn't.
Out on the streets, the newsies are calling out the latest headlines.
Shocking new murder twist. Read it in the world. Police can't find Guldenzupa's head. Suspect could walk if it doesn't turn up only in the Journal.
The race to crack this story is a dead heat.
You know, Audible has a brand new collection of exclusive thrillers. Every move is made more exciting by captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. I just downloaded The Grand Opening by Carl Weber. It's a mystery about a family business in a small southern town, and there are secrets around every turn. You know, when I'm listening, the time just disappears, getting completely immersed in the story and the performances. And as an Audible member, you get to keep one title a month from their entire catalog, including bestsellers and new releases. So come on, listen along. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Head on over to audible.com/BW or just text BW to 500-500. That's audible.com/BW or text BW to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. We get support from Acura. The spirit of performance is what defines Acura. And now, it's electric. Introducing the ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
While the world and the Journal battled each other, what were New York City's other major dailies up to? Imagine you are an editor at the New York Times. You and your competitors are all based on a single block called Park Row, conveniently located across from City Hall and next door to the post office. Being an editor at the Times is a pretty impressive position to have now, but in the late 1800s, not so much. You're being left in the dust by the World and the Journal. Every day you show up for work, And every day, as soon as you go through the other papers on your desk, you feel defeated. At the Times, your liability is an unwavering commitment to playing things down the middle. You believe in objectivity. You want to tell the story, not become the story. You refuse to stoop to some of the other paper's dirty tricks. But squeeze in next to the Tribune, the Daily News, and all the others, your Times looks like an also-ran. Not until 1902, when it opened its spectacular new tower at 42nd Street and Broadway, the building that gave Times Square its name, would the New York Times start to distinguish itself in the media world that Hearst and Pulitzer made. In the meantime, the job of calling out the Journal and the World would fall to the New York Sun. Until Hearst and Pulitzer came along, it was the city's most popular paper, led by famed editor Charles Anderson Dana. A fierce intellectual, he regarded photography as a passing fad and turned up his nose at advertising, obviously to the Sun's eventual peril. In keeping with the personality of its editor, the Sun often played the role of skeptical observer to the spectacle of the headless torso case. It never hesitated to poke Hearst or Pulitzer for their shenanigans. In the mad scramble to find Gulden Zuppa's head, the underbrush near the murder site in Woodside, Queens, was combed for clues. The discovery of a brown derby hat with a bullet hole prompted breathless reports in the papers. But the Sun blasted Hertz and Pulitzer, accusing them of planting false evidence to snag a headline. Woodside is undergoing a boom in the agricultural line, the Sun jabbed. They plant blood-stained clothing and bullet-perforated hats, and within a day or two, they raise a crop of fakes. Despite these transparent gimmicks, the World and the Journal were thriving because of America's circumstances at the time. The Gilded Age was also the ambiguous age. The nation's identity was still being molded. Cities were being dramatically transformed by massive immigration. The country's business tycoons, also known as robber barons, still had not been brought to heel. Their ruthless pursuit of wealth ultimately threatened the survival of the barely century-old country. Corruption was rampant because the rule book for many parts of society and commerce had yet to be written. The press had mushroomed beyond its modest ranks during the colonial era, but it still had no governing ethos. In this environment, Hearst and Pulitzer succeeded because they were not afraid to try new things. Their own restless nature, not just their rivalry, drove them ever forward.
It's August 1st, 1898. Among the 28 witnesses allowed inside the execution chamber, two, naturally, are reporters from the World and from the Journal. Hayden Jones and Langdon Smith have both been chosen for this ominous assignment because of their lightning-fast telegraph skills. They're here because Martin Thorne is slated to die in the electric chair for his role in the murder of William Gulenzupa. Right now, Thorne is waiting in his jail cell. It's his last day on Earth. He has requested a final meal of roast beef, turnips, and rye bread to remind him of his childhood in Prussia. As he's finishing, the warden approaches.
The hour has come. All right. I want to thank you for your kindness.
As Thorne is led into the death chamber, his eyes meet the gaze of Jones and Smith. The journalist got to know the condemned man during his trial and time in prison as they turned out scoops. Thorne gives them a half smile and slides into the chair without any prompting. Even in death, the look seems to say he is a sure bet for the front page. Prison officials strap him into the chair and nod to the executioner in the next room to throw the switch. Electricity surges through Thorne's body, throwing it against the leather straps. His limbs convulse and his neck bulges. But when the voltage stops and a doctor checks for a pulse, he finds Thorne is not dead. The electric chair is a new invention and it's not yet reliable. Thorne's botched execution would take hours. It created a smell witnesses compared to that of a hot iron on wet linen. As horrific as it is, the newsmen are jaded.
Lord, it smells like a tannery in here. How is it possible Thorne still has a pulse?
You got me. They haven't made it official yet.
Poor bastard. Isn't this the final insult?
Smith checks his watch.
Well, I don't know about your shop, but mine is expecting a story.
It's not like he's going to get up from that chair and walk out of here.
On with it, then.
The urgency to get the last news out was so intense that neither Jones nor Smith ended up waiting through the whole protracted affair. They started tapping out their dispatches as Thorne's body was carried to the autopsy room. Doctors had to cut Thorne open to make sure his heart had actually stopped. In the end, he wound up carved up on the exam table, bizarrely echoing the fate Guldenzupa met in that bathtub in Queens. Coverage in the afternoon editions of The World and The Journal mostly skipped over the chair malfunction. Instead, they spun one final yarn shot through with puritanical bloodlust. Sketches in the journal showed anatomical close-ups of what the journal called the dead man's degenerate ear and pugnacious nose. It was the last time Martin Thorne would make the front page of the journal. Martin Thorne had been arrested a few months earlier by undercover detectives. The capture took place at Spears Drugstore, on the busy corner of 125th Street and 8th Avenue in Harlem. The Journal and the World had tracked down a barber who worked with Thorne. He had later tipped off the detectives that Thorne had been running his mouth off about the murder. The papers had caught a break with the barber, but they also ran a series of stories saying that Thorne, who was considered a person of interest, may have left the country. Some of the paper's so-called experts even theorized that the headless victim may not even be William Guldenzupa at all. This was the constant, frantic rhythm of the paper's reporting, some complete fabrications, along with provably true scoops. Now, the detectives, they knew their man had never fled the country, and they knew the victim was indeed Guldenzupa. But they liked that the paper's flurry of speculation might tempt Thorne to get cocky and make a mistake. So they laid a trap. On a steamy summer night, as patrons fanned themselves at the soda fountain counter at Spears, the lawmen posed as laborers. Wearing soiled overalls, they lined the street in front of the drugstore as dusk fell. When Thorne approached, they seized him in a flash, hustling him inside and pinning him on the counter. They frisked him, pulled out his handgun, and slapped the cuffs on.
Martin Thorne, you're under arrest for the murder of William Guldenzupa.
Yes, I am Martin Thorne. How did you find me?
Let's just say I know a good tip when I hear one.
Stephen O'Brien, the arresting officer, had been on the case from the beginning. He jockeyed with a journal in the world as he tried to collar the perpetrator. The newspapers blazed quite a trail, but they needed a real cop to get the collar. When he was apprehended, Thorne didn't run or even struggle. In fact, he seemed to melt into the floorboards. He would put up a defense at trial, but for now, he was just exhausted. Augusta Knack would eventually give her full confession, which the jailed Thorne only learned about from reading the New York World. Knack, who manipulated the press like a puppeteer during her stay in prison, was spared Thorne's grim fate. She turned state's evidence on her accomplice, was released from prison after 10 years, and quickly disappeared from public life.
The battle between the World and the Journal over the headless torso case was essentially a draw. Each paper profited mightily from orchestrating interest in the case, even though they had each poured millions of dollars into the effort. Their coverage created a new kind of reporting. The headless torso was one of the first truly mainstream news events that the entire nation shared in via the media. Newspapers, not the police, were cracking the case and taking the entire nation along for the ride. But the headless torso case would end up being a relatively innocent phase for the World and the Journal. In the coming years, both papers would play fast and loose with the facts in the name of a good story with far larger stakes.
Hey, Prime members, you can binge every episode of Business Wars ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
On the next episode of Business Wars, we'll look back at the winding paths that brought Hearst and Pulitzer to the top of their media empires. The story involves robber barons, the Statue of Liberty, and outsized characters like Nellie Bly, the adventure journalist who circumnavigated the globe in just 72 days. With feats like these, Hearst and Pulitzer would captivate the country's imagination. The only question was how to keep the public paying their 2 cents a day to come along for the ride. I'm your host, David Brown, along with Lindsey Graham. Dade Hayes wrote this story. He's a contributing editor at Deadline Hollywood and author of the books Anytime Playdate and Open Wide. Our senior producer is Karen Lowe, edited and produced by Jenny Lauer, sound designed by Bay Area Sound. Our executive producers are Marshall Louie and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.